Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. 26 Answers to 26 Reasons is a live recording of a midweek class conducted by Pastor Lancaster in 2009 to answer common anti-missionary objections to the gospel. The class purchased and used Asher Norman's book, 26 Reasons Why Jews Don't Believe in Jesus, as a textbook for discussion. This book is available from Feldheim Publishers, copyright 2007. You can join the class by listening along as we defend Messianic Judaism and the claims of the New Testament. To support Beth Emanuel in this important work, click on the Support tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
Reason number 23, the historicity of Jesus is problematic. And so what Asher Norman is going to do at this point is he is going to shift gears a little bit and begin to start an attack on the historical credibility, not just looking at discrepancies in the Gospels or something like that, as he has been doing, but actually shifting to say, to advance an argument saying, well, we really don't know that there ever was such a person, that there really ever was a Jesus Christ or Yeshua of Nazareth. And so that's going to be the approach. But he starts out this chapter by saying, how is it possible for the historical facts to be so garbled? And he's speaking of the fruits of his last several chapters, where we looked at the, you know, for example, the resurrection narratives and the conflicts in the resurrection narratives from one gospel to another. And then he says, well, you know, the reason that it's possible for it to be so garbled is because the history is invented. So the premise that he's going to put forward now, and I'll warn you, this is not his something that he came up with himself. This really gets to the heart of the liberal agenda about Yeshua of Nazareth. So you'll find this is pretty much the approach of the Jesus Seminar. This is the approach of liberal scholars, and I mean left of left liberal scholars, as they approach faith and they approach the Gospels. So you will also find that what we are going to discuss, this absence of a historical Yeshua, the absence of a historical Jesus, is a really popular notion. This might surprise you, but it's a popular notion in a lot of Christendom as well. In fact, I would say that even the more literalists, the biblical literalists, segments of Christianity, really, if it came down to it, they would be just as happy to do without the historical Jesus and just stick with the sort of divine Jesus of theology and not deal so much with the Jewish guy who says all sorts of unpleasant things. Yeah, difficult and unpleasant things. But that's a different subject altogether. What am I talking about? Well, let me make it real simple. Jesus didn't exist. Instead, there was these sort of pagan ideas that are all thrown into a hodgepodge and into one version of a guy, and then later retrofitted with a historical story to make it sound more believable. That's what's being suggested here. So he's going to give us a quote from a guy named Robert Price. Robert Price was a member of the Jesus Seminar. I know all about him because I looked him up on Wikipedia. He was a member of the Jesus Seminar. He's a friend of Greg Boyd's, apparently. They like to argue with each other. They have debates with each other. So he wrote a book called Christ, a Fiction. And he's written other works along the same lines. But as I look at Robert Price's theories, they do fall into this Well, he says it best himself. Listen to this. He says, the life of Jesus as portrayed in the Gospels corresponds to the worldwide mythic hero archetype in which a divine hero's birth is supernaturally predicted and conceived. The infant hero escapes attempts to kill him. He demonstrates his precocious wisdom as a child, receives a divine commission, defeats demons, wins acclaim, is hailed as a king, is betrayed, loses popular favor, executed often on a hilltop, is vindicated and taken up to heaven. These features are found worldwide in heroic myths and epics associated with Hercules, Apollonius, Padma, that's some Indian name, Buddha. The more closely a supposed biography corresponds to this plot formula, the more likely an impartial historian is to conclude that the historical figure has been transfigured by myth. In the case of Jesus Christ, virtually every detail of the story fits the mythic hero archetype. With no additional biographical secular historical information, it becomes arbitrary to assert that there must have been a historical figure lying back of the myth. Okay, so there's a problem with this approach. What he's done, and this is what's going to cause us so much sorrow when we get to the next reason. I've been dreading the next reason. What is that? Reason number 24. Yes, I've been dreading that one this whole class. Not because it's insurmountable, but because it's going to require work. And, you know, like more than half an hour. So I'm kind of dreading that. But here's the premise. You take all the elements of the gospel story. For example, born of a virgin. See if there's any mythological, on the whole mythological landscape, can we find any miraculous births? It doesn't have to be born of a virgin, but just someone like a miraculous birth. Got one. Okay, great. How about this one? Performed miracles. Now let's check the whole mythological landscape. Can we find anyone who ever performed miracles? Oh, got one. You know. And so by starting, using the gospel story as your starting point, and then going out and pulling, you can then come back and say, look, this is all found in mythology. This is all mythological. So this is what he's done. And this is exactly what reason number 24 has done. Through some very creative retelling of mythology to make it fit the gospel better in order to discredit the gospel better, in fact. It's some really, really bad junk scholarship, which is the worst kind, because that takes, you know, the only way to fight junk scholarship is with real scholarship, and that's hard work. So, dreading that. Anyway, so Robert Price is, you get the idea with Robert Price? It's just too mythological. It fits the story of too many mythological characters to be true. You know, C.S. Lewis had the same objection. We'll talk about this when we do the next lesson. Maybe I'll find the passage and give you the quotation. But C.S. Lewis had the same objection, but on much firmer ground, because he was a real scholar. And you know, he said, you know, this God who dies and comes back to life, that's something that we find in a lot of pagan stories, you know? That's the dying God that comes back to life with the cycle of the spring and the winter and, you know, rebirth. So he said, you know, that's why I'm not a Christian. And J.R.R. Tolkien, his friend and writer friend and tavern buddy, said to him, yeah, that's true, but this is God's mythology. So he said, rather than try to defend it and say, oh, no, it's not mythological. I know it sounds mythological, but it's really not mythological. Tolkien was very pleased to have God's version of the mythology and say, yeah, that's right. It is mythological. But this one's God's mythology. This one is the true mythology. It worked for Lewis, brought him to faith. That's why he became the great Christian apologist and scholar. That was the argument that flipped Lewis, was this idea, God's mythology. Okay, well, we're not... So I wish he hadn't brought that all up already, because that's really the next reason. Getting back to this reason, that the historicity of Jesus is problematic, he says, the works of 41 historians who lived during the first century and early second century and wrote about Judea and Rome have survived. And then he gives a list of these historians, many of which I've never heard of, but that's not surprising. Significantly, none of them mentioned Jesus, his alleged disciples, his apostles, or any of the so-called miraculous events described in the Gospels. It's difficult to understand how this is possible if the Gospel stories about Jesus described historical events. Okay, first, 41 historians in the first century and second century, not one of them, he says in that first sentence, says anything about Jesus or the apostles or the miracles or anything. How is that possible? Out of 41 historians, that no one mentions it. Well, five do. There's five, and then he'll go on and say, well, five do, and he's going to work towards, for the rest of the lesson, discrediting those that do. So five out of 40, well, and even, you know, that's even, the fifth one's the Talmud, so we'll pull that one out. Say four out of 40, that's 10%. Mm-hmm. That's pretty good. For a little slice of land, that's quite a bit off the beaten track of the Roman Empire. You know, these, it should hardly be surprising to us that I find it surprising that there's four historians that mention this small messianic sect of Judaism that to the outside world, to the pagan world, would look completely like any of a bazillion other little Jewish sects that were, you know, operating within greater Judaism. So, you know, how many holy men are there? I mean, it's like, oh, another Jewish holy man. You know, it's not... It's not surprising to me at all that there would not be mentioned. We're talking about Galilee here. It's like Iowa, you know. This is flyover land. It's between Alexandria and Rome. Israel would be flyover land. It's not going to make it on the historical map. If it wasn't for Josephus, who was from Judea, we would know hardly anything about the history of Israel in the Roman period. So Josephus and the New Testament are our primary sources of Judea.
Did he do that, or did he just happen to be in that area?
Well, that's a good question, and we're going to meet him. In fact, let's do that now. Josephus. What do we know about Josephus? His name, Yosef ben Matityahu. And he had his name changed to Titus Flavius, or actually added Titus Flavius Joseph. So Yosef is Josephus. He was a guy. He's a priest. He was a Cohen, born in 37 Common Era. So he was born about 3 years, or about 7 years after the master died, right? So he wouldn't have known him. And As someone who's born 7 years after the master died, he's actually in the end of what we could call the apostolic period. So he's like he's around and operating at the tail end of the apostolic period. He's born in Judea. He served as a priest, as far as I know, or at least he was of a priestly lineage in the temple era, and he was a politician and a leader of a revolt, the leader of the Jewish revolt, one of the generals up in the Galilee. He was, if you believe him, he was the head of the Galilean resistance to Rome when the Roman legions were coming in. The city that he was defending finally fell to the Romans. He and his buddies hid themselves away in a cistern. They made a suicide pact, like these guys are always doing. Josephus was the guy holding the lots that were being drawn, and lo and behold, at the end, it was just Josephus and one other guy were the last two to be surviving this suicide pact, and so then they knew that there was just two of them, and it was time for them to do each other. You know, they do this; they would shack each other. That's how the Jews would do suicide pacts. So this is pretty much everybody knew how to shack from temple sacrifices. It's painless. But they had a different idea. There was the two of them. It just occurred to them, you know, hey, why don't we just surrender instead? So after everybody else had died in the cave, these two go out and surrender. And they turn themselves over to the Romans. And Josephus then becomes, this is for Vespasian, he becomes Vespasian, his interpreter. And he speaks all the local languages. So Josephus is present at the siege of Jerusalem. And he documents the whole thing. So he documents the whole end of the apostolic era. He's the guy who the Romans have, like, standing outside the camp, yelling up at the walls, "Resistance is useless! Surrender!" You know, that's his job. He's a traitor. He wins the affection of Vespasian and then his son Titus by chronicling it all for them. And he becomes part of the family, so to speak, of this imperial family. Goes back to Rome, a great historian now. He's a great chronicler. In order to fight off some of the anti-Semitism that's come in the wake of the Jewish revolt, he writes a book called Antiquities of the Jews, which is a long history of the Jewish people. And that, coupled with his book Jewish War, the great works of Josephus. So that's Josephus. Tells us a lot. You find a lot. You learn everything in Josephus. You really need. I tell people, if you want to be present, like in the master's world, you need to read Josephus and the sages. You can't just read the sages, because if you just read the sages, you would think that everybody is a rabbi walking around in a long flowing robe, like doing the mitzvahs like to a hyper extreme level. You know. You also need Josephus to bring balance to that picture, where you realize that, oh, it's a very, very secular world. Much, much more like, I mean, I think of reading Josephus as kind of like, when I was a kid, we watched this show called Dallas. Did you ever see that?
Yeah.
We would watch this show called Dallas. It was a soap opera. This is like, you know, so Josephus is kind of like watching Dallas. It's power struggles. It's extremely secular. It's a soap opera. It's, you know, these families are, you know, it's exciting. There's always somebody getting poisoned or drowned or something like that. You know, it's you know, and oh my goodness, can you know, that sort of thing. So that's the other side of the story. And you put these two, you put the picture from the sages, the religious guys, together with Josephus, the secular guys, and you get the real picture of what was going on in the first century. His credibility is high, and it's the stuff he reports has been proven out time and time again by archaeology and so forth. He's an eyewitness to almost everything he's reporting on, except where he's reporting before his day. He exaggerates. He is known to exaggerate, but most historians and writers were at the time. So you generally, I think, with ancient writers, you can, whenever they give figures, you just figure it's multiplied by a factor of 10 or 100. Yeah. Kind of like missionaries, isn't that? In terms of politics, his credibility is suspect because he is a court writer. So Jewish War reads very much like an apology for Rome. Say, well, you know, Rome was really decent to those people, and they just so ungrateful, you know, and we tried not to burn their temple, and, you know, but they forced our hand, you know, and so on and so forth. So you really get a sense of, you know, the bandits had it coming, but they probably did. It's complicated. You just have to read it. Anyway, that's a long introduction. Remember we were talking about this last time then? This passage in Josephus where he mentions the master. This is a famous passage. It's called the Testimonium Flavianum. Testimonium Flavianum. Everybody say it. Testimonium Flavianum. Okay. So, the testimony of Flavius, in other words. Here it is. Here's what he says about our master. Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, because the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the sect of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct at this day. That's the quote. There's some real problems with it. First of all, if this quote is authentic to Josephus, if Josephus really wrote this, he's a believer. And there's nothing in the rest of his works to suggest that he's a believer whatsoever. In fact, you could make the opposite argument. Now, he does talk about John the Baptist. He gives us our best information on John the Baptist outside of the New Testament. Our only information on John the Baptist outside of the New Testament. Talks about James, the brother of the Master. So, you know, he is familiar with the characters of the times. And so it would be very surprising if Jesus of Nazareth actually did exist that he wouldn't mention him. But this is a problem. And so as we said last time, it's generally been understood by scholars to be an interpolation. That's a $5 word. Interpolation means something that somebody else stuck there. So this is generally understood to be something that Christian scribes copying Josephus stuck there. And in fact, there's even a theory that Eusebius, Constantine's scribe, was the one who stuck it there. Why do we assume it's an interpolation? Notice each of the statements that I've italicized. Each one of these statements that I've italicized, if it be lawful to call him a man, he was the Christ. He appeared to them alive again on the third day, because the divine prophets have foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. Each one of these are statements of faith that would only be made by a Christian. So, it's clearly an interpolation. Now, what I was mentioning to you last time, though, is that it's possible that it's only that the entire passage has not been inserted, but possibly it's only been monkeyed with. And so scholars took out, generally, what they would do is they'd say, those scholars who believed that it might be a genuine passage in Josephus, what they did was they took out the italics, what I've italicized, basically. So, you know, it would read something like, about this time, Jesus, a wise man, a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as loved the truth, drew many Jews and Gentiles. Pilate had him crucified. Those that loved him didn't forsake him. The sect of the Christians, so named, are not extinct to this day. That is a very believable presentation of the historical facts as a historian would relate them. So it was an interesting thing when in 1971, Shlomo Pines, who was a Jewish, not a believer, but a Jewish professor, published a different translation, a different version of this passage of Josephus that he had found in an Arabic manuscript. Okay, so this is a 10th century Arabic manuscript that was quoting this passage, and it's very different the way it reads. So listen to this version. At this time, there was a wise man who was called Jesus, and his conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. And many people from among the Jews and other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die. And those who had become his disciples did not abandon their loyalty to him. They reported that he had appeared to them after 3 days after his crucifixion, and that he was alive. Accordingly, they believed that he was the Messiah, concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders. That's a far more believable version of Josephus. So what I'd like to suggest to you is that that's the original. And at some point, a Christian scribe reading the original of Josephus felt uncomfortable with it. Felt like, we can improve that. And improved it for us. The problem with improving it for us is it removes its credibility, and so now we no longer know if it's an authentic passage or not whatsoever.
How important was, or do we know how important Josephus was in the early years? I mean, we know that, you know, we count on him for information today.
That's a great question. That is a great, fabulous question. How important was Josephus in the early years? And scholars who would say that this is not an authentic passage would say, here's the proof. The church fathers, if they had this passage, they would be quoting this all the time. But they don't. How is that possible that through the first 3 centuries, the church fathers aren't quoting this passage? But the answer to that is, the church fathers aren't quoting hardly any Josephus. A little bit here. A little bit there. But for the most part, the church fathers don't have Josephus. It's not like it's in circulation. It's important. The material is important. But I believe it's not until Eusebius in the 5th century, 4th century, in the 4th century, Eusebius copies long passages of Josephus into ecclesiastical history that it takes off. And it becomes a big deal. Anyway, the other reason that the church fathers would be less satisfied with this passage as it stands without the interpolations is, well, because it sounds like a historical presentation. It doesn't, they claimed and so on and so forth. Anyway, no scholar that I know of disputes the second passage in Josephus, where he's talking about James. He says, regarding James, the brother of the master, this is speaking of the high priest Ananias, or Annas. He assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others, or some of his companions. So this is when James is put to death. So here we have another passage in Josephus. Nobody disputes this passage, that this is an authentic passage. And it has a direct reference to Jesus, who is called Christ. Okay, so indisputable, I think, it's indisputable. We have a solid first century historian who lived in the apostolic period, who knew of the master, knew of his name, knew his reputation. Perhaps if this passage is authentic, knew the details of the claims. But anyway, he knew James, he knew of John the Baptist, and he knew that the notoriety of James, the brother of the master, was that he was the brother of Yeshua. That's what we learned about tonight. When you go home, you say, we learned about the Testimonium Flavianum. Okay. Next guy. Tacitus. Or would you say Tacitus? This is Latin. Tacitus. Tacitus. Yeah. I think it is Tacitus, but I would say Tacitus. It's a Roman senator in the apostolic period. Here's what he says as he's telling the story of Nero's life. He's, as a historian, he's writing down the story of Nero's life. He says, to get rid of the report, the report that Nero started the fire when Rome burned. To get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations called Christians, or Christians, by the populace. Christus, this is, you know, that is Christ. It's Christos. This is the Greek. So in Latin it sounded like Christus. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous suggestion, thus checked for the moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, the first source of evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all men, of all who pleaded guilty. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of crime the crime of firing the city, starting the city on fire, as of hatred against mankind. So they decided, well, we can't really convict them of all of burning the city. Let's just accuse them of hate crimes committed against humanity. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. So this is the persecutions during the days of Nero by a historian who lived in that period. This is when Peter died in this era. Both Peter and Paul died in Rome in this period of persecution. So here you have a historian, not only familiar with the persecution of Christians, but familiar with their founder, knows enough of the story to know where he was put to death, knows the procurator who signed the execution, and so on. So this is a solid source. You might wonder, how does Asher Norman deal with that? Well, let's find out. Here's what Asher Norman says. He says, he mentioned that the name Christians originated from a person named Christus who had been executed by Pontius Pilate. He never mentioned Jesus, only a person named Christus. Okay, moving on. Suetonius, Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus. He wrote a biography of the emperors. And here's another guy. He's born at the in the late apostolic period and lives into the second century. He's writing about the era of Claudius, which is the time when Paul would be running around and spreading the gospel. And he says, since the Jews constantly made disturbances, this is Claudius is in the 50s. So we're talking about 20 years after the death and resurrection. Since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he, that is Claudius, expelled them from Rome. So he kicked out all the Jewish people out of Rome because he was so sick of the Messianics. I can understand. He expelled them from Rome. So he expelled the whole Jew. This is a huge community. The Jewish community of Rome is a huge community. We're talking about tens of thousands. He expelled the whole Jewish community from Rome because they were making so many, disturbances at the instigation of Crestus. I don't know what those disturbances were. I don't know what they look like. But this is really interesting information because we know Christianity came to Rome very early, came to the Jewish community in Rome very early. When Paul arrived in Rome and he wrote to Rome, he was writing to a community that he did not begin and that was well established. It was an old community. We would expect that there's something going on there in the 50s. Also very interesting, two Jewish believers from Rome find themselves out looking for work at about this period of time. Do you know who these people are?
Priscilla and Aquila.
Yeah, would have been kicked out of Rome with that expulsion. And they end up in Corinth with Paul. So, anyway, what's the point? The point is it's another guy from the period that has heard of Crestus, knows about Crestus, Christ, Messiah, and his followers. What does Norman say? If this Crestus refers to Jesus, then this passage contradicts the Christian story of Jesus, who was supposed to have been crucified by Pontius Pilate. He therefore could not have been instigating in 49 Common Era during the reign of Tiberius. Further, Jesus was never supposed to have been in Rome. So he says, obviously not the same guy. We're not talking about Jesus. This is happening in Rome. Jesus died over in Judea. So, do you understand what he's saying? The point?
Not relevant.
It's not relevant because that's not what Claudius never said. The Crestus guy was present in Rome. Number four, Pliny the Younger. Or if you prefer, you could say Pliny. Pliny the Younger, not to be confused with Pliny the Elder, who is also a famous historian and was his uncle, lawyer, and so forth. You know what happened to Pliny the Elder? You'll never forget. See? I told you, you never forget. He's across the water, when he's across from Pompeii, when he sees this incredible sight. He's like, what is that? Is that a storm cloud? What's going on over there? You know, it looks like it's Mount Vesuvius blowing its top, right? Yeah. So he says, I'm going to go over there and see what's going on. That was the end of Pliny's uncle. Anyway, so Pliny the Younger, in the days of Trajan, sends a letter to Trajan. Okay, so we don't want to read the whole thing. He sends a letter to Trajan. I'll just read you a little bit, give you an idea of it, okay? He says, it is my practice, my lord, to refer to you all matters... Trajan's the emperor, by the way, at this time. It's my practice to refer to you all matters of concerning which I am in doubt. For who can better give guidance to my hesitation or inform my ignorance? I have never participated in the trials of Christians. I therefore do not know what offenses it is the practice to punish or investigate, and to what extent. And I have been not a little hesitant as to whether there should be any distinction on account of age, or no difference between the very young and the more mature, whether pardon is to be granted for repentance, or if a man once, has once been a Christian, it does him no good to have ceased to be one, whether the name itself, even without offenses, or only the offenses associated with the name are to be punished. So he has an order as some sort of administrator or governor or lawyer. He has an order from the government to punish and persecute and put Christians to death. And basically he's writing to the emperor and saying, could you be more specific? Meanwhile, in the case of those who were denounced to me as Christians, I have observed the following procedure. Here's what I did. One, I interrogated these as to whether they were Christians. Those who confessed, I interrogated a second and a third time, threatening them with punishment. Those who persisted, I ordered executed. So he interrogates them once. Are you a Christian? Yes. Wrong answer. Are you a Christian? Yes. Wrong answer. Are you a Christian? Yes. Three yeses, you're dead. For I had no doubt that whatever the nature of their creed, stubbornness, inflexible obstinacy, surely deserved to be punished. There were others possessed of the same folly, but because they were Roman citizens, remember Paul pulling out his Roman citizen card, I signed an order for them to be transferred to Rome. Soon accusations spread, as usually happens, because of the proceedings going on, and several incidents occurred. An anonymous document was published containing the names of many persons. Those who denied that they were or had been Christians, when they invoked the gods in words dictated by me, offered prayer with incense and wine to your image, which I had ordered to be brought for this purpose, together with the statutes of the gods, and moreover, cursed Christ, none of which those who really are Christians, it is said, can be forced to do. These, I thought, should be discharged. So here's his plan. He rounds up these Christians. He obtained a document with a list of names, right? So someone sold out a community. Said, yeah, I'll tell you everyone. It's jerks, I used to go to their church, you know. he gives them the directory, you know. He's got the document. He rounds them all up and he says, okay, I've got Trajan's image here. Here's some more gods. All you gotta do is offer some incense to these gods, bow down, worship them, and curse Christ. And you're free to go. And so those who would do that, he let them go. Those who wouldn't, he put them to death. So, and the letter goes on like this, you know, for quite a ways. Actually, it's a really important document because it describes the early Christians. You know, I'd say it's outside of the apostolic works. It's our earliest description. Trajan. We're talking about what? 110? 100 Common Era? 110? Something like that. Anyway, why is it important? It's incredibly important. Here you have, within less than a century after the death and the resurrection, an account of the believers and their steadfast faith in this. This isn't just like sort of being hodgepodge put together, like let's pull out some mythical ideas, and it's not like the thing is like kind of growing as an evolving mythology or something like this. All right. what do we say? What does Norman say about Pliny? The letter says nothing about a recent historical man. It simply mentions that certain Christians had cursed Christ to avoid being punished. It does not mention Jesus or claim that this Christ really existed. It only proves that in the beginning of the 12th decade, Christians did not normally curse someone called Christ. Right? Okay. It's true. But you're missing the point. The point is there were Christians.
And they were willing to die.
And they're willing to die for this. Yes. And I would say that's the strongest historical evidence that you can possibly provide is the existence of Christians. Just like this. How do you know that there ever was an Irish guy named Kelly? You don't. But the existence of Kellys proves it. How do you know that there was some Norwegian forefather named Knut? You know? How do you know that? You don't. You don't have, I mean, is this a historical person that we can document? Or no. I mean, what historian is talking about Knut? We don't know, you know. Well, you know, maybe there's some Knuts in some of the sagas or something like that. But the point is that there was someone named Knut. And he had a son. And his son was named Knut's son. You know, so Christians are very much the same. There was a Christ. There was a Jesus, a historical Jesus. And the existence of believers is strong historical proof of that. You don't have to prove it from a negative. You don't have to start from zero. Okay. Pardon me?
How do we know there was a Moses?
Yeah, how do you know there was a Moses? Exactly. Right. In fact, find me one historian that says there is a Moses.
Well, you know.
Do you want to know? Do you want to know what Trajan wrote back?
Yeah.
Trajan writes back after this. This letter went on for quite a while, quite a ways, but with some really interesting stuff about torturing people and so on. But Trajan wrote back and he says, "You observe procedure properly, my dear Pliny. In sifting the cases of those who have been denounced to you as Christians, it is not possible to lay down any general rule to serve as a fixed standard. But they are not to be sought out. If they are denounced and proven guilty, they are to be punished with this reservation that whoever denies that he is a Christian and really proves it, that is by worshipping our gods, even though he was under suspicion in the past, shall obtain pardon through repentance." The last one he cites is the Talmud. Okay, the Talmud is a problem. He points out that the historical value of the Talmud for information about Yeshua is problematic because both of the characters that the Talmud identifies as Yeshua, Yeshu ben Pandira and Yeshu ben Stada, and I was going to read you a couple of these passages, but they've been edited out by the church in the Middle Ages. So I can't, but at least out of this version. I was going to read you a couple of these passages about Jesus in the Talmud, but they've been edited out of this version. No, they were edited out by the church, by the Vatican, about 1,000 years ago. And so you need to have a different version. This isn't a critical version. So you need a critical version. We need some history lessons. Yeah, the Vatican
had a lot. Hand it over to a Vatican.
They didn't hand it over. The Vatican controlled everything. They controlled everything. So I mean, in those days, the Vatican could, you know, they would if they didn't like, if you printed a book they didn't like, if you printed an edition of the Talmud they didn't like, they would order them to be rounded up and burned, and they would have to be rounded up and burned. If you didn't do what they said, they would stick you in the Iron Maiden, and it wasn't a rock band. The Vatican had complete. Absolute control prior to the Renaissance era, prior to the Reformation.
Wow.
Yeah, so the Vatican can, you know, tell you what to cut and what to delete and what you can print. They tell you what you pray. They edited the prayers. I mean, like the Eleinu, the part of the Eleinu where it says they pray to a God which does not save. They bow to emptiness and pray to a God which does not save. The Vatican took that out of the Eleinu. That was only put back in the Eleinu 15 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, this I would, you know, okay, so good. That brings us to close this off. These passages about Jesus in the Talmud, we can't get into them right now. There's too much there to study. It's really fascinating stuff. The problem is with these passages that they lack any historical credibility, as Asher Norman points out, because the sages that they associate him with, when they in both cases, belong to the wrong eras. So what's happening is in the Talmud, you have that typical Talmudic blender effect where you drop in a bunch of sages and a bunch of eras and a bunch of teachings and traditions. You stir them up through a couple centuries of study halls and then write them down. And it's what comes out is so confused in terms of its historical value that you can't quite pin it anywhere. You can't peg it, I mean, anywhere. And so both of these, both the representations of Jesus from the Talmud have problems that make them not historical, which is good. And why is that good? Because they're not friendly. These presentations of Jesus are not friendly in the Talmud.
Is that why the church took them out?
Yeah. That's why the church took them out. Now, the one I really wanted to read to you, though, is the one from Sanhedrin, where it says, it talks about the death of Jesus on Erev Pesach. That it says, you know, the Sanhedrin hung him on Erev Pesach. They sought for someone who would stand up as his defender. No one would. That's a quality source. And then it goes on to talk about disciples of his that were also put to death by the Sanhedrin. And one of them is a guy named Mattai. That's Matthew. One of them is a guy named Booney. I don't know who Booney is. One of them is a guy named Tobias. So we're getting names of disciples that in Talmudic tradition, they remember the Sanhedrin put this guy to death. The Sanhedrin put this guy to death. These were disciples of Jesus of Nazareth. So there are problems. Historically, there are problems with the Talmud as a source. But nevertheless, it preserves an independent tradition of a memory of Yeshua of Nazareth and his disciples in that community. So this is a pretty easy one. The historicity of Yeshua is not a problem. Reason number 23 falls down.